this message titled Mediator in Suffering from Job chapter 9 verse 1 through chapter 10 verse 22 was preached at Winchester Reformed Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Kansas. For more information, visit us at winchesterrp.com. Well, I remember a number of years ago when I was still in college, I had formed what you might call a decent working relationship with one of my professors. And my senior year, my professor invited me to go for a walk outside. She wanted to review and discuss a paper that I had recently written for class. And so we were walking through the community in which the college was located, and I don't exactly remember how, but our conversation got turned to Christianity. And she knew that I was a Christian. I had written some papers defending Christianity in my philosophy classes. She had interacted with those a little bit, and somehow our conversation got turned to that topic. And I distinctly remember on that April day, she said to me, she said, "You know, Kyle, I haven't always been a non-Christian." I said, "Well, explain that. What do you mean by that?" And she said, "Well, I actually grew up in the church. I grew up going to a Christian school. I am still married to a man who is a very committed, very strong Christian. There came a point in my life when I rejected the Christian faith." And being a little curious, I said, well, why did you reject the Christian faith? And she recounted for me the story of when her first son was born, her first child. And he was born with a life-threatening defect. And though he has grown up now to become a very healthy young man, she admitted that as she was cradling her newborn in her arms, this little infant that was born into a life of suffering, that she could not reconcile that experience with what the Bible says concerning God. And she reasoned that God cannot be real to allow my son to come into this world and before he takes his very first breath, he is suffering. And I asked her, "How did you resolve it then? How do you resolve the issue of suffering in this world if you reject Christianity?" And she said, "Well, that was when I became a Buddhist." I said, "Well, that's very interesting. What advantage does Buddhism have over Christianity when it comes to suffering?" And she told me this, and I know this is a broad generalization, but she said the very heart and the very center of the Buddhist philosophy or the Buddhist religion is that though suffering exists in this world, our task in this life is to cease from suffering. And she said, and Buddhism gave me the answer that if I give in to meditation, if I turn my eyes inward, if I learn how to conquer and control my desires, then I remove myself in this life from the reality of suffering. So that suffering is no longer part of my life. It is no longer in my mind. It is no longer in my heart. And you see, brothers and sisters, behind that philosophy, behind that religion, behind that kind of attitude, is something that says this: suffering is a useless byproduct of our world. The attitude that lies behind that is one that says suffering is inevitable, but it's fruitless. Suffering is unavoidable, but it is meaningless. It is without value. It is without purpose. And our only goal in life, in this life, is to transcend suffering. And I want you to know this morning, brothers and sisters, that that attitude is anti-Christian. That attitude, difficult as it is for us, is anti-biblical. No one wants to suffer. I don't want to suffer. You don't want to suffer. I don't want you to suffer. And I trust this morning you don't want me to suffer. Nobody wants to suffer. But the Bible reminds us again and again that though suffering is not what we would choose for our lives, that in the hand of the sanctifying Spirit of God, our suffering is not useless. Our suffering is not fruitless. Our suffering is not meaningless. It's Charles Spurgeon, the 19th century preacher who suffered tremendously in body and soul, once said, "I have had to learn to kiss the wave that throws me against the rock of ages." Christianity, brothers and sisters, does not teach us to detach ourselves from suffering in this life and to rise above it. But the Bible teaches us that suffering is intended to drive us to Jesus, to embrace Him by faith. And this morning, we see this in the example of Job. We see this in Job's example. Remember from last week that Bildad, Job's second friend, has sought to speak to Job in his suffering. And again, I want to remind you that the sin of Bildad is not that he sought to speak to Job in the midst of his suffering. We are to encourage one another. There are times to sit in silence, as Job's friends did, but there are also times, brothers and sisters, and we need to be guided by wisdom to speak a word in season to those who are suffering. Bildad's error, Bildad's sin, is not that he decided to speak to Job, but his great error is that what he spoke was really pretty worthless counsel. You remember the sum and the substance of Bildad's response to Job. He said, "Well, Job, look at what the fathers teach. Look at what tradition says. Tradition says the righteous person flourishes in this life. The unrighteous person suffers. Job, you're suffering. Therefore, the logic is you're unrighteous." And we saw last week how Bildad's counsel really comes from a distorted picture of who God is. It comes from a distorted picture of what the life of faith looks like. And it comes from a distorted picture of the truth. And now Job responds in chapters 9 and 10 to his friend's worthless counsel. Job responds. And as the chapters progress, as it unfolds before us, what we see and what I want to show you this morning, if the Spirit is willing, is that as Job's words come forth, we find that Job, even in the Old Testament, centuries before the eternal Son of God became man, we find that Job is longing in his suffering for Jesus Christ. And I want to show you that this morning. And so let us ponder first suffering's question. Suffering's question. Look at chapter 9, verse 1 and 2. "Then Job answered and said, 'Truly, I know that it is so.'" Let's just pause there for a moment in the middle of verse 2. "Truly, I know that it is so." Again, last week we saw Bildad's counsel, what was counsel that was really terrible at face value. But we also noted last week that not everything that Bildad said was false, was it? And that's one of the things that makes the book of Job so tricky for us. As Job's friends speak, there is always a hint, there is always a little nugget of truth in what they say, but then they begin to deviate just a little bit, and they end up far afield from the truth of God. And Job here, as he begins to respond to Bildad, we can imagine, especially after hearing what Bildad had to say, that it would be very easy for Job to swipe it all away and to say, "Oh, Bildad, you're a worthless counselor. All your words make no sense. You are a man," as Job will later say, "who is full of hot air. And you're just spewing off nonsense." It would be easy for Job to say that. But I want you to notice what Job actually says. He says, "Truly, I know that it is so. I know that it is so." Even as he goes on to argue much of what Bildad says, Job still recognizes that not everything that Bildad said was wrong. And we noted that last week in the third verse of chapter 8. What is it that Bildad begins with? He begins with this question to Job. Does God pervert justice? Or does the Almighty pervert the right? Bildad is saying, does God make crooked straight paths? Does God twist and turn things? Does he make good bad? Does he make bad good? Does he make right wrong and wrong right? And we saw last week, and Job affirms here, no, God never perverts the right. God never makes crooked that which is straight. And Job acknowledges, at least in part, that what Bildad has said, there is an element of truth. And if I can just make a peripheral application this morning, there is perhaps a note of encouragement in that for us, especially for those who suffer. Brothers and sisters, people rarely say all the right things to you when you suffer. People rarely say all the right things to you when you suffer. Job's friends certainly didn't. But even here, Job has the grace to acknowledge some truth in what Bildad said, though so much of it was worthless counsel. And Job says, "I know that it is so. I acknowledge it. I admit it. I profess it. I believe it, Bildad. God is just." Job is saying, "I agree. We are agreed on this principle. God does not make crooked those paths that are straight." What a tremendous example Job serves. That even in the darkness and in the pit of suffering, he will not ultimately blaspheme the very character and nature of who God is. "Truly, I know that it is so." But then what does Job go on to say? In verse 2, "Truly, I know that it is so." And then he asks this question. "But how can a man be in the right before God?" Very simply, to word that just a little bit differently and fairly, according to the grammar, Job is saying, how can a man be righteous before God? Job is asking the question, how can a man be justified in the sight of God? How can a man be upright in the presence of God? Or as some translations put it, how can a man prove himself to be innocent in the presence of God? And of course, it makes sense why Job asks this question. Because Bildad has rigidly applied the justice of God. The righteous don't suffer, Job, but the unrighteous do suffer. You're unrighteous, and so you suffer. And now Job comes back and says, "I admit that God is just. I acknowledge that. But Bildad, if it is only the righteous who prosper," Job's question is, Bildad, who's righteous? If it's only the upright who prosper in this life, if it is only those who are in the right that flourish, Job's question, the question that comes in the midst of his suffering is, who on earth is righteous before God? How is it even possible? And brothers and sisters, I want you to know this morning that that is a phenomenal question. That is a question that the Bible teaches you and me to ask. That is the question that is at the very root of the thing we call the gospel of Jesus Christ. How can man be right before God? It's the question that is at the heart of the redemptive work of Jesus Christ. It is the question that opens the door to the glorious gospel. If I can put it bluntly, there is no more important question you can ask in your life than the question, how can I be right in the presence of God? The Apostle Paul teaches us to ask that question. In Romans chapter 3, verses 10 through 11, what does Paul say? Paul says, there is no one who is righteous. There is not one. There is no one who is good. There is no one who understands. And then what conclusion does Paul come to? Do you remember in Romans chapter 3, verse 20? He says, therefore, the law condemns all of us and it stops our mouths before God. Paul says, here's what we've got to do when we ask this question and we turn into ourselves for our own resources and our own reasons. The only thing that you and I can do is clap our hands over our mouths, because all of us are guilty in the sight of God. There is not one who is righteous. No, not one. And Paul there in Romans teaches us to ask that question out of the sense of our own guilt and our own acknowledgement of sin. But Job teaches us to ask that question in the midst of suffering. In the midst of suffering, even there in the darkness and in the depths, we are to ask this fundamental and important question: how can a man be in the right before God? And if it teaches us anything, brothers and sisters, it teaches us this. In a world that is so satisfied with cheap platitudes and Hallmark cards, when the Christian suffers, they are not content with shallow answers or shallow questions. But you throw yourself to that most fundamental of all questions: how can a man be in the right before God? Suffering teaches us to ask that question. And it reminds us that the gospel of Jesus Christ has everything to do with our suffering. The gospel of Jesus Christ does not stand over here while we sit in suffering. Our suffering is to lead us to the gospel. There's suffering's question: how can a man be in the right before God? But that brings us to a second point this morning, and that is suffering's dilemma. Suffering's dilemma. So suffering's question: how can a man be in the right before God? And as Job begins to try and answer that question, what we begin to see as this chapter develops is that Job is pulled into a tremendous dilemma, a tremendous difficulty. Right? He asks this question in verse 2. How can a man be in the right before God? And then in verse 3, if one wished to contend with him, to argue with him, if one wished to make his case before God, to try to dispute with God, that's what Job means there. If one wished to contend with him, Job goes on to say, one could not answer him once in 1,000 times. You parents have probably used an expression somewhat like that. Sometimes my kids come to me and they ask me a question. Hey, Dad, can I do this or can I do that? And I say, no, you can't. And 2 seconds later, they come back and say, well, are you sure I can't do it? And what do you want to say to them? It doesn't matter how many times you ask me. You can ask me 1,000 times. The answer is still no. And Job is saying that those who wish to contend against God, that's the place they're going to find themselves. They can try to open their mouth 1,000 times. They can try to answer him 1,000 times. But they're never going to be able to stand before God as one who is right, as one who is just, as one who is upright in their ways. And Job goes on to demonstrate why, doesn't he? He goes on to demonstrate why there's this tremendous dilemma, this difference between who God is and who Job is. Look first at how Job begins to describe God. In verse 4, Job writes, he is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and succeeded? Job asks this question. He begins to grapple with the idea, the significance of who God is. And he says, don't you understand that God is wise? That God is mighty in strength. And to demonstrate that fact, Job then, we might say, averts his eyes to creation, doesn't he? In verse 5, he who removes mountains, and they know it not. Right? God is strong enough, Job is simply saying, he is powerful enough to remove mountains. If you've ever stood at the foot of a mountain, you could kick it and punch it as many times as you want, and it's not going anywhere. And Job says, that's not God. God removes mountains. God has the power and the strength to do that. He actually overturns them, Job says, in his anger. Job says it is he who shakes the earth out of its place. Its pillars tremble. In verse 7, it is this wise and this powerful God who commands the sun, and it does not rise. The power in God to speak a word, and the sun itself would yield perfect obedience to him. Job says it is he who seals up the stars, who alone stretched out the heavens. I know you've all seen a starry sky. You look up and you see a canopy of stars. And Job says it's God who seals that. It's God who stretched that out. It is God who made the Bear and Orion. He's speaking there of the constellations. You know, I looked this week and those stars that make up what we call Orion's belt, what Job is referring to here, those three stars. The difference in distance, they look very close together to us, but the nearest star in Orion's belt to the farthest star in Orion's belt is a difference of 1,100 light years. I can't even begin to calculate that. And Job says, this wise and powerful God, he put them there. He stretched out the heavens. He tramples the waves of the sea. You remember 14 years ago or whenever it was, that terrible tsunami that hit Indonesia, and Job says, God tramples waves. They're nothing to him. They're less than a puddle. Job says that in verse 10, it is he who does great things beyond searching out and marvelous things beyond number. To put it very simply, Job is saying, God is powerful beyond your imagination. There is more power, there is more wisdom in God than you can begin to fathom and to search out. And creation bears witness to it. Creation bears witness to the greatness and the significance of who God is. And Job is saying, He is beyond me. He is beyond us. He is beyond our imaginations. And brothers and sisters, we need to remember that. Too many of us have too small a view of who God is. But Job here is grappling with the greatness and the significance of God. So great and so significant is He. And then Job, we might say, turns his eyes from looking upward to looking inward. And he begins to compare himself to the greatness of God. In verse 14, he says, "How then can I answer him, choosing my words with him?" Job is saying, "Who am I compared to this God who is beyond all imagination?" You ever asked a question similar to that? You ever stood by a mountain, looked up 14,000 feet, and grappled with the question, "Who am I? How little, how puny, how tiny I am compared to the mountain before me?" You ever stood on the shore of the ocean and seen the waters stretch out for endless miles and asked that question, "Who am I? I'm like a grain of sand to this seemingly infinite ocean." You ever stood in the presence or had a conversation with somebody whose intelligence is tremendously greater than yours, and you're humbled, and you say, "That person has forgotten more than I will ever know." You ever compared yourself to, humanly speaking, a person on earth who has near unlimited power? Who am I to the President of the United States of America? Who am I to kings and queens in this world who have so much power and so much authority in this world? And it's very easy to begin to feel tiny and to begin to feel small. And you see, brothers and sisters, that's where Job is. This is where the dilemma arises from. He asks that question, who can stand and be right in the presence of God? And as Job begins to try to answer that, and he grapples with the greatness of who God is, he comes immediately to terms with who he is not. Who am I? I am nothing compared to this wise and powerful God. I am as nothing. I am so insignificant. That's what Job is saying. And he goes on in verse 16, "If I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice." Job is saying he's too preoccupied. He's too great. He's too exalted to even listen to the words that are coming out of my mouth. That's what Job is saying, and it's drawing him into this tremendous dilemma. It is the dilemma of the greatness of God compared with his own insignificance. And what is the conclusion that Job comes to in all that he's saying? It's found in verse 32. "For he..." That is God. "God is not a man as I am." God is not a man. God has not been formed from the dust of the earth, and to the dust he will never return. God does not grow weak and weary. God doesn't live with a limited perspective. He doesn't eat the bread of anxious toil. He doesn't work the ground by the sweat of his brow. God is not one who lives his life in ignorance or without knowledge. God is not mortal. He does not suffer. He is not living as one under the sentence of death. God is not beset with afflictions. God is not frail. God is not easily overcome. God is actually not at all overcome by his situation and his circumstances. God is not bound by the chains of passing time. Job says, God is God. God is not a man. I am a man, but that is not God. God is not a man like me. And in saying this, what Job is doing, if I can put it this way this morning, he is positing an infinite gulf, a broad, broad valley between himself on one hand and God on the other. And he is saying there's no comparison. There is no unity here. God is not just a bigger version of who I am. I am not just a smaller version of who God is. Job is saying there is an infinite gulf that cannot be overcome. And as he wrestles with that, he begins to despair of his own insignificance in all of his suffering. You can think of it this way, that Job's mind is saying how insignificant my suffering is to the one who is not a man. And Job's giving in to that pity, that he's uncared for, that he's neglected, that he's ignored by the great and significant God. And that is a dilemma. It is an experience that many have. Finally, this morning, let's ponder suffering's longing. Suffering's longing. We see the place where Job is. Job asks that question, how can a man be in the right before God? Job sees himself in this difficulty, this dilemma. God is not man. I am insignificant. Does God even care for me? And again, brothers and sisters, that is an experience that many, many Christians have. And it is so easy to slip into that place and to feel utterly defeated when you suffer. To think, in all of my suffering, God doesn't notice me. He's got better things to do with his time, the one who casts the stars into the sky. He has better things on his mind than me. And he doesn't notice me. And he doesn't regard me. And he's not sympathetic to my sufferings. Brothers and sisters, there are many suffering Christians who are there. And maybe this morning, it's where you are. And as you sit in suffering, you ask those questions, does God even notice me? Who am I to appear before God? Who am I to speak to him? Who am I that I think in the midst of my condition, my weakness, my suffering, my sorrow, how can I approach God? And God doesn't seem real to you, but he's far off. He's up there, and you're down here, and you're struggling, and you're suffering. You see, that's where Job finds himself. And what does he say in verse 33? There is no arbiter between us. Or perhaps your footnote, there's some grammatical complexities there that we're not going to get into. But most translations footnote at the bottom of the page that Job is saying there, would that there were an arbiter between us. Expressing this wish, expressing this desire, expressing this longing that between him and God, filling that gulf, filling that broad valley, oh, that there would be an arbiter between us. An arbiter isn't a word that we use very often, but it's the same word that we get the word umpire from. One who judges a case. One who determines what is right. It's the same word that we get umpire from. It is the same word we get mediator from. Remember when I was in middle school, our school system thought it would be great to begin to teach us how to do problem resolution. And so they took a number of students and they made them peer mediators. And what they were to do is whenever there was a conflict in the student body, the two students that were fighting would sit on either side of the mediator, the peer mediator, and the peer mediator would work through the certain issues and work through the problems. They'd put themselves in between. And that is actually exactly what Job is saying. I want a mediator. God is way over here, and I'm way over there, and what I need, oh, that there would be one who stands between us, one who has the ability to stretch forth his hand and to put it on my head, and to stretch forth his hand and put it upon the head of God. Brothers and sisters, that's what Job is longing for. It's as if he has no more energy and no more strength. And he says, I want somebody to do it for me. I am exhausted. I can't plead my case. I can't make my argument with God. I don't trust myself. I don't trust my thoughts. And I don't trust my feelings. And I don't trust my words. Oh, that there would be one to stand between us. And one who would stretch forth his hand and lay it upon me. Someone who understands me. Someone who sympathizes with me. Someone who can take the groaning of my soul and give expression and words to my suffering. That's what Job is longing for. As if to say, oh, if only there was one to stand in the gap between God and me. If only there was one to stand in the gap between wise and powerful God and miserable me. Do you see what Job is saying? Do you see what Job is actually longing for? Brothers and sisters, he is longing for Jesus Christ. Centuries before the eternal Son of God, the only begotten, took to himself human nature. Way back in the Old Testament, Job, as he sits in the darkness of suffering, longing for an arbiter, longing for a mediator, is longing for Jesus. It is the Apostle Paul who said in that verse we opened with this morning, there is one God and there is one mediator between God and man, the man, Christ Jesus. And Job is longing for him. And he is longing for one who understands him. He is longing for one who sympathizes with him. And does Jesus sympathize with our sufferings? The author of Hebrews says it in Hebrews 4:15. He is a sympathetic high priest. Brothers and sisters, does Jesus know what it is to be in darkness? Absolutely. Jesus knows what it is to be in darkness. Does Jesus know what it is to struggle? Yes, Jesus knows what it is to struggle. Does Jesus know what it's like to be in despair? Absolutely. Does Jesus know what it is to hurt and to suffer loss? Does Jesus know what it is to be betrayed by those who love him and whom he loves? Does Jesus know what it is to be depressed? Does Jesus know what it is to have a pained body? Does Jesus know what it is to be let down? Does Jesus know what it is like to feel abandoned in our experience of God? Yes, he does. Jesus knows. And do you think this morning that Jesus understands what it is to be in a position that is unjust? He does. And Job is longing for him. Whether he can give full expression to that or not, we'll see in coming chapters how clearly Job's faith comes to embrace a Redeemer. But whether Job himself is completely conscious of what he's longing for here, he is longing for the only mediator between God and man, the Lord Jesus Christ. And Jesus understands. He sympathizes with us in all of our sufferings. And you see what this is a call to, what this compels us to do, is in all of our suffering, if I can put it this way, to fall into the arms of Jesus. To have Jesus say, I know what you're suffering. And I love you, and I have loved you with an everlasting love. Jesus will catch you and lift you and carry you. And here, the very thing that Job longs for is the sum and substance of what we preach: Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Job's suffering does not make sense to him. His friends cannot give reasons for it. They cannot explain it away. But brothers and sisters, Job's suffering is anything but useless, because it drives him and brings him to Jesus. And your suffering is intended for the same thing: to bring you to the one who is eternally God, but to bring you to the one who is like us in every way, who has suffered more than any other, to cling to him, to cling to the one who is the mediator between God and man, and in him and by him and through him, one can be right before God. Let's pray.